reporting the news with respect, both for the facts and our listeners. We are a member of the Radio Television News Directors Association.
The Wave, CJLS.
The first to go into battle, the last to go home. This is the legacy of a group of Canadian soldiers in the Second World War. They were the 2,000 men of the Royal Rifles of Canada and the Winnipeg Grenadiers, who fought against an overwhelming force of Japanese invaders in the Battle of Hong Kong. Outnumbered and outgunned, their battalions were virtually wiped out of the Canadian Army. In a 17-day battle defending the 100-year-old British Crown Colony, 290 Canadians were killed and another 500 were wounded. 270 more Canadians would die as prisoners of war during 4 years of systematic torture, brutality, and slave labor at the hands of their captors. In December 2005, six former Canadian POWs returned to Hong Kong to remember their comrades and to celebrate the 60th anniversary of their liberation. It was the last official ceremony marking the Year of the Veteran. Ray Zink traveled to the Far East with the delegation from Veterans Affairs Canada to tell their story. His documentary report is entitled Heroes and Heartbreak.
They shall go not old as we that are left go old. Age shall not weary them nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
December 1941, Hong Kong.
I'm Douglas Rees, Royal Rifles of Canada, is here in 1941. It was a sense of a sore defeat. We took it as a defeat, not a surrender, and it was hard to take, but yet we realized that it was the only way out.
My name is George McDonnell. I'm 83 years of age. I live in Toronto, and I served in the Battle of Hong Kong. An army of convenience that fights when and if it likes is of no value to anybody trying to win a war. And we had to win that war. The 38th Japanese Division, which faced us, was badly damaged in the battle. The Canadian soldiers who died in Hong Kong and in the prison camps later made their contribution to our victory over the Axis powers. Yes, we lost the Battle of Hong Kong, but we didn't lose the war, and the people who were killed and died in the process made just as big a contribution as anybody else.
I'm Bob Foss-Creighton from the Royal Rifles of Canada, and I was here on Christmas morning when the Japanese broke in. The Japanese came in about 5:30 in the morning.
St. Stephen's Hospital.
They immediately started killing the men in their beds. I had been taken upstairs then because I'd been wounded early. I'd been operated on and everything else, and then later when more wounded men started to come in, then I got moved upstairs, which was fortunate for me too, but still upstairs. The same things happened. And one fellow in particular, Emile Bernard, they come in and he was in the bed and he had a broken leg and he had an eye blown out, part of a hand blown off, part of a foot. And they just come in and tipped his bed over and then hit him on the side of the head with the bayonet. As the day progressed, they would come in and pick somebody out and take him out of the room. And later on, though, when the fellows that were on the burial detail went out and found these fellows, they'd been mutilated and tortured. And I knew two of them personally, but I'm not going to mention their names. I wouldn't want that to get back home. And the nurse that looked after me, I didn't know who she was at the time. I found out after. She was a Mrs. Beggs. And later when they raped and killed the nurses, she happened to be one of them. It's something you never forget, eh? Every Christmas morning I'm here instead of being where I should be, you know. You try to forget what you can't, and you don't forgive.
The sound of gunfire was almost constant during the day. At night, shells whistled.
A terrific stench filled the air. The bodies of the dead were rotting in the bright sun. Exhausted soldiers slept and buried their faces in their arms in order to keep out the stench of death. Excerpt from the book, Not the Slightest Chance, The Defense of Hong Kong, 1941, by author Tony Benham.
I'm Jessie Clayton, and I'm the wife of Robert Flash Clayton. We were married in 1946. For the first 5 years, he didn't realize that he was home and that he had, was matured. He was still 19. And he might go fishing on Friday and come back on Monday. This continued for 5 years, and gradually he settled down. But you must remember that for the first 5 years, every time I turned around, there were 7 or 8 of them in my living room, and they were reliving it all again, which was good because it was a catharsis for them all. There was a bad side. They escaped into themselves, either through drinking Dawes Black Horse Ale. They still have nightmares, all of them. He's had the same section of men on a hill, and he's trying to get them off all the time. And as I told him one morning, if you don't get them off soon, I'm going up there. I've had a lot of people say to me, for heaven's sakes, it's over 60 years, they should forget. I said, we weren't there. We weren't young and impressionable. We cannot say they should forget.
My name is Phil Doddridge. I'm the national president of the Hong Kong Veterans Association of Canada. I live in New Richmond, Quebec.
Phil Doddridge spent nearly 4 horrendous years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp here in Hong Kong. He was one of the lucky ones. 264 Canadian prisoners would die from torture, starvation, slave labor, and disease.
Well, North Point Camp was the worst place because the Japanese had used the camp as a corral for horses, and there were fleas and bed bugs and lice and much filth flying around, and we were left to our own devices to make the place livable. And it wasn't easy because we had no hot water, no soap. We were always hungry, every day, all day, and you'd wake up hungry and go to sleep hungry. It was a while before the lack of the proteins caught up with us, and we started to get show signs of that in various ways. Beriberi and pellagra and malnutrition of many different sorts. And of course the conditions led to an outbreak of dysentery, and that claimed a few lives. And for me, it was, I think, even though I was sick after that with diphtheria and other diseases, I think that was the worst for me. Dysentery is a terrible disease, and I spent a terrible time. By the end of 1945, I weighed 104 pounds, which was pretty good because I was a small guy. And because some guys whose average weight had been 180 to 200 pounds were down to 100 pounds, which is, you know, they were just walking skeletons. I recall the first piece of white bread and butter that I had, and it tasted like the best cake that I had ever eaten. When I got access to good food, I overdid it, and I developed a case of jaundice and became very ill. I mean, nauseated like I've never been before, and I was a week or so overcoming that before we even sailed from Hong Kong.
Oh, there was always hope. I mean, there was a will there, a will to live, I guess.
Douglas Rees, originally from Newfoundland, spent many years in Japan as a prisoner of war.
In Yokohama, I worked in the shipyard as a riveter, and it's hard work at the best of times under the best of conditions. My weight eventually went to 90 pounds. I was about 150 when I joined the Army, yeah. There was one point in Sham Shui Po when we first came off our rations. Shortly after we came off our own rations, I became blind all of a sudden, and they tell me it was related to the sudden drop of whatever your system needs. I was blind for, I think, about 3 months. Not totally blind, but I could not see. All I saw was a mist. A figure was just a misty figure, until it came within 2 feet or so of me, and then I could distinguish who it was, but that was still a blur. And another point, I had dysentery so bad, we had a go-down, what we call a warehouse, a rice go-down, next to the camp, adjoining the camp, which was supposed to be a hospital, a dysentery hospital. Well, that dysentery hospital, I would rather have been anywhere but in there. We had a lineup of buckets at one end of the building, and by the time he got to the buckets, you know, it was too late. He walked back through what you were going to do, you know, this type of thing. And there was no food. I was in there for over a week, and there was no food.
They were young, as we are young. They served, giving freely of themselves. To them, we pledge, amid the winds of time, to carry the torch and never forget. We will remember them.
As these aging veterans of the Battle of Hong Kong pay tribute to their fallen comrades so long ago, they only have to look around to see their sacrifice was not in vain. Over 200 students from the Durham Remembrance Group of Southern Ontario are here to bury a memorial capsule at the Sai Wan War Cemetery here in Hong Kong. The capsule contains poems, stories, music, and artwork to commemorate the Canadian soldiers buried here. Veterans Douglas Rees and Bob Clayton say the trip was worth it just to see the faces of these young people.
My name is Linda Stewart, and I'm currently living in Victoria, British Columbia. I was born and raised in Winnipeg. My father was a Lance Corporal with the Winnipeg Grenadiers. His name is Clifford Joseph Carpenter.
In addition to the students, there was another group here in Hong Kong, the Veterans Commemorative Association, a younger generation of Canadians who had relatives in Hong Kong during the Second World War.
The story he told us was that he had a pair of pearl-handled revolvers that he took into the camp with him, and they were searching all of the prisoners, the duffel bags, when they brought them into the camp, and my dad had the pearl-handled revolvers in the duffel bag. The Japanese soldier that was questioning him got fixated on a picture that he had in his wallet. It was on one side was a picture of my mother in the summertime in a summer dress and looking gorgeous and beautiful, and on the right hand side was a picture of her in the wintertime outside in a heavy winter coat. I mean, we're Winnipeg, we're, yeah. And a hat, and this guard became just obsessed with this. He says, oh, two WIFO, you have two WIFO in Canada, two WIFO. He says, no, he's trying to tell him, no, it's the same woman. Dad was trying to tell him, no, it's just her. And the Japanese sergeant or whoever it was at the front of the line shouted out some orders, and this guy was taking too long with my dad. And so he went on to the next man without searching his duffel bag. And had he found those pearl-handled revolvers, he would have been dead on the spot. They would have shot him. One day a Chinese girl about 5 years old came to the fence, and a Japanese guard bayoneted her, killed her, and they put up, they got together a detail to go outside the fence and bury this little girl, and he took that opportunity to bury those two pearl-handed revolvers with her to reduce this risk of being killed.
Death was an everyday part of life in Japanese prisoner of war camps. 4% of Allied prisoners held by Nazi Germany died during the war. In Japanese prisons, that number jumped to 27%. But there was another, albeit less known, side of the Japanese. Douglas Rees and George McDonnell still remember those times.
There was one interpreter in our camp. It's not a nice word, but we called him Mushmouth because of the way he spoke, I guess. And we didn't take kindly to him until we knew who he was and what he was doing. And he kind of warned us about inspections at night when we went to camp, back in the camp. In 1966, when I came back, we went to Tokyo also. And this gentleman made a point of coming to the hotel to see us. And we greeted him with open arms, believe me.
We went into Stanley Village, where we had a major battle the day before, to see if we could bury our dead. When I got to the Japanese lines, a sentry sent for a Japanese officer, and when we explained to him what he wanted to do, he agreed completely, and they didn't molest us or interfere us, and we found and buried the Canadians, and they were doing the same with their dead. And in the case of our famous General Lawson, they were so impressed by Lawson's resistance a few days before that when he came out of his bunker to fight his way out and regain his troops, he was killed, and they were so impressed by him that in the middle of the fighting they built a wooden monument and were careful to mark his grave. They were so impressed with him. So yes, they were savage in some ways, and they were quite reasonable in others.
Brigadier John Lawson, a decorated soldier from the First World War, was the first senior Canadian commander killed in action in the Second World War. Refusing to withdraw from his bunker in the face of a Japanese onslaught, Lawson told his commanding officer he was going outside to fight it out, reportedly with a pistol in each hand. And there were other Canadian heroes during the Battle of Hong Kong. One soldier earned the first Victoria Cross of the war.
The Diary of a Soldier from the Winnipeg Grenadiers, December 19, 1941.
I was with a group that included Sergeant Major Osborne, who was about 20 feet away from me. I saw something land near Osborne, perhaps a grenade, but it looked bigger to me, more like a mortar. I dropped to the ground and covered my head with my arms. The explosion lifted me off the ground. When I looked up, Osborne was gone. But the guys further up the hill said that he had thrown himself on the mortar, probably saving my life.
Excerpt from the book Not the Slightest Chance, The Defense of Hong Kong, by author Tony Banham.
My name is Tony Banham. I'm an amateur historian. I've been studying the Battle of Hong Kong for nearly 20 years. The war here in Hong Kong, of course, was relatively short, but it did involve Japanese casualties. It did involve Japanese equipment being destroyed or expended, and it did tie down a good number of Japanese troops. And the Japanese problem during World War II was one of a lack of resources. So any resource they lost during the fighting, wherever it was hard or even impossible to replace. So one can say that the Battle of Hong Kong, despite the fact it was small and very early in the war, was one battle in the long battle of attrition that eventually allowed the atomic bomb to be dropped on Japan and therefore end the war. I think defending Hong Kong was never really an option that was likely to be successful. However, the efforts made here against the Japanese in general did contribute in the end to the successful Allied victory over Japan.
When we went down the mine, we were taken down.
Veteran Ed Shaler of Calgary. At 87, he's a survivor extraordinaire. He not only survived the Battle of Hong Kong and 4 long years as a POW, many of them in slave labor in the coal mines of Japan, but he has also beaten 3 bouts of cancer since the war.
I had been in some of the shafts when the temperature had been as high as 130 degrees. Oxygen was another problem, and it was brought in a perpendicular shaft like a chimney. But if the draft didn't work properly, naturally there was a lack of oxygen in the mine. You couldn't leave the mine until you finished your quota. A couple of times, it wasn't very often that we weren't able to finish it, but a couple of times we weren't able. And all that happened, when the day shift come down, you stayed, and you stayed with the day shift. They wouldn't take you up during the middle of that shift. And that meant you didn't get up from the mine until your next shift went up, which would be, if you were a night shift, it would be the following morning.
I'm Jerry Girard, and I fought in Hong Kong here in 1941, and I was taken prisoner of war. I spent a little over a year in Hong Kong, and then I was shipped to Japan, to a place called Kawasaki, just outside of Yokohama. The Japanese were quite brutal. Once they thought they could push us around, which they could, and you always had someone with a rifle in your back while they'd slap you around, they'd punch you. If you didn't fall down, they'd put a leg behind you and push you over, and then they'd put the boots to you. They were just plain vicious. Anything they could think of to do, they would also lure you into a position where they could give you another beating. And one particular one was an interpreter from Kamloops. All we know about him was he lived in BC. He went to Vancouver University, and just before the war, he was one of about 150 Japanese who went back to Japan, and he became an interpreter. And I don't know whether he was trying to get even with the way he was treated in Canada or not, but he really looked for trouble the whole time. And one day we had a mistake when we had to line up and be counted. There was one extra man in the hospital part, and so we were one short in our lineup. So the captain in charge of our parade, he gave him a severe beating right in front of all of us. And this was really bad. We were, everybody wanted to jump in, but you had rifles behind your back.
150 civilians, mothers with a baby in one arm, children of 4 and 5, crying and frightened, were marched to a hillside castle. Along the way, we saw some of the bodies of the soldiers we had known during the siege. Many others were in agony from bayonet wounds inflicted in idle thrusts by their captors. We pass a wounded man crawling to an aid station. The Japanese bayonet him. All of a sudden, the Japanese soldiers started to bayonet our unsuspecting men from the rear amidst cheers from enemy onlookers. Bodies were kicked into the ditch. Excerpts from the book Not the Slightest Chance, The Defense of Hong Kong, by author Tony Banham.
They may have been cruel with us, but I think they were crueler with the Chinese. I know I watched one officer practice his jiu-jitsu on a Chinese coolie. Now, that man didn't offer any resistance at all, but he just kept throwing around till finally he cracked his skull on the pavement and then turned around and walked away. It was really grueling. When we were in Hong Kong, we had to be in the parade square when dawn broke. We would get back at night, and you'd be in the parade square and counted just about when it got dark. We would work a week, 2 weeks, never get a day off, and you never even saw the place you slept in daylight. And the work was unbelievably hard. If you ever tried mixing concrete by hand, you know what we were doing all day. Then in Japan, they issued us a suit of work clothes. That one suit of work clothes I wore for 2.5 years, patches on patches. We sewed it together with thread that we took off rubber hoses. We'd peel the rubber off and then take the thread off it and use that to patch our clothes.
On the last day of their pilgrimage, these six veterans, George McDonnell, Phil Doddridge, Douglas Rees, Bob Flash Clayton, Ed Shaler, and Jerry Gerard, gather at the Stanley War Cemetery to remember their comrades, just as they did a few days earlier at Sai Wan War Cemetery here in Hong Kong. But even in their grief for those who never came home, these veterans are also here to celebrate the 60th anniversary of their own liberation as prisoners of war. Such a monumental moment in their lives so long ago brings back sharp memories. Ed Shaler says he'll never forget the day he knew the war was over because it came with a double-edged sword.
To me, this was one of the most traumatic days of my life. The reason I say that is because we had learned that the Japanese intended to destroy every prisoner of war without trace. Not all of us were privy to this information, but I was, along with some of the others. And there was something that happened here that was a little different this day. We could tell by the attitude of the guards as we went down. They seemed a little more pleasant. So because of that, we all had the fear that we would be destroyed this day, and the only thing we were concerned about was how would it happen. We thought possibly they would disappear and blow the mine off. You're full of fear. You think of nothing different. And there was an interpreter there. His name was Nucci, and we trusted this man. And he said, they dropped a big bomb last night. And somebody says, how big was it? Kill a lot of people. He says, around 150,000. Not enough of the bastards, somebody said. I think I was the only one there that understood. And I thought for sure the repercussions were going to come now. Nothing happened. And I went and lay down, fell asleep. And then there was a man, and he shook me, and he said, wake up, war is over, get the hell out of here, because we have heard this so much, many times. And then I heard the biggest grounder in the place holler out, I'm not going to eat any more goddamn rice. Now, when that fellow says it, there has to be something to it. I started to shake. I cried. And then I prayed. This, to me, was the hour of truth in my life.
The hour of truth in Ed Shaler's life resounded throughout the Japanese prison camps, whether they were in Hong Kong or in Japan. One of the most unusual stories about the day the liberation came is recorded in George McDonnell's book, One Soldier's Story. McDonnell writes that the Allies had the temerity to order their Japanese guards to surrender.
We were in northern Japan in a camp called Ohashi in the mountains. And when the emperor spoke to the Japanese people and brought the war to an end, he spoke by radio. And we were placed way in the bowels of the mine so we wouldn't hear it, and the Japanese thought that we didn't know the war was over. Now, we also knew that the camp commander had sealed orders to kill us if there was any possibility that we could be retrieved by our own forces. And in fact, the Japanese did that in other areas. And so we were in a power vacuum. We didn't know whether the camp commander was going to carry out his orders. So after a day or two, when he didn't send us to work, but he wouldn't tell us the war was over, we took him down and showed it our clandestine radio, which we then tuned into the American base radio station being set up in Tokyo, and said, "You see, the war is over, and from now on you're going to take orders from us. MacArthur is the commanding general and the power authority in Japan. This young American captain is our senior officer. He reports directly to MacArthur. You will take his orders from him." And it worked, because I think the Japanese officer, the camp commander, didn't know what to do. And being a Japanese soldier, he was very anxious to do whatever was appropriate. And so we managed to escape any real difficulty until the American Marines found us and rescued us.
Some of these soldiers would never be quite the same again.
The numbers tell the story of these soldiers. Out of 2,000 men from the Winnipeg Grenadiers and Royal Rifles who served with a small British garrison here in Hong Kong in December 1941, nearly 300 were killed in action. Another 265 Canadians would die as prisoners of war. The nagging question over the last 60 years has been this. Was the Battle of Hong Kong, which pitted an under-equipped and outnumbered Allied garrison against battle-hardened Japanese shock troops, simply a waste of young lives? Lieutenant Commander Reed Cudmore, an Armed Forces chaplain who accompanied these veterans, wrestled with this same question.
In the other cemetery, Saiwan, I saw there was a young Marine who died when he was only 18 years of age, British Marine. So that's a perfect example, British Canadian or whatever nationality. And on the surface, it's very much a waste, but as one person here in the contingent quoted to me the biblical expression, pardon me, "A greater love hath no man than this, and to lay down one's life for one's friend." And when you place that particular quote in the context of war, covering for your buddy, or look at our friend, the sergeant, who threw himself on the grenade here in Hong Kong, there's no greater way to preserve the well-being and sanctity of your comrades than to do that. So we might, as I said before, it might seem on the surface a waste, but in the big picture, it's not.
Each veteran dealt with the unspeakable waste of young lives in war in his own private way. Many never spoke of it after the war, but now, 60 years later, Ed Shaler, Bob Flash Clayton, and Jerry Gerard reflect on what sustained them through all the carnage.
There's always the thought of home. Anyone that is in a position where they may lose their life, the natural instinct is to survive that. And you hope that maybe tomorrow it would turn different.
I was worried about my mother. I knew she would be going absolutely crazy. And I kept saying, "Ma, am I all right? Ma, am I all right?" And when I got back home, and Ma said, "Bobby, I woke your dad up." And I said, "Bobby was in this room saying, 'Ma, I'm all right, Ma, I'm all right.'" And she said, "I never worried after."
I think we started with about 150 on our crew and ended up with less than 50. I was fortunate that I kept my health and I'm grateful for that.
As national president of the Hong Kong Veterans Association, Phil Doddridge had these poignant words for his fellow veterans. He wrote, "I was looking for some justification of the death, sickness, and hunger that we all experienced. Perhaps one of my buddies would whisper from the grave, 'I wanted assurance there is victory in death, that there is a guarantee of a reward for the loss of life in these brutal struggles.'" But for Phil Doddridge, with tears in his eyes, this is an elusive answer to something he sought all his adult life.
I know several of the ones who are buried here, and particularly Frank Cormier, who came from my hometown. It's sad, and it's I hope some closure, but I don't think that'll ever come.
As these aging vets prepare to return home, their memories of what happened here so long ago will endure. But the parting words of veterans Douglas Rees and George McDonnell suggest the horror of their memories have eased just a bit. Perhaps a lasting legacy of this one last pilgrimage to the Far East by Veterans Affairs Canada in this Year of the Veteran. I'm Ray Zink in Hong Kong.
I'm so pleased that I did return. Very pleased. And I don't know, it's a sense of, people say a sense of closure. But you know, 60 years later, to have to wait for that closure is a long time. I feel very comfortable now with everything.
I've often thought that if we could speak to those who are buried here, if they could talk, they would tell you that they have no regrets. They could lose their lives. They knew that. The sacrifice was great, but the price of victory was greater.